And I just deeply apologize that I don't have a quiz tonight that you could have been working on. But I think Sam will make that up to you Sunday morning. So maybe you have a quiz to... I know those are just enjoyable and everything. But really, we have... I've kind of adjusted this schedule so that it looks like I'm working according to plan. But actually, we need to finish this lesson tonight. It is shorter. I don't really know why I put this one to be two and the nature of God to be one, but it makes more sense what we're doing here. I'll just review the sequence of lessons. The nature of God. Does anybody want to call out the ologies that go with these? What's the study of the nature of God called? Theology. Good, that's good. How about the nature of man? Anthropology, I guess, although that's kind of become a kind of a science, more about history and culture and stuff like that, as opposed to the moral nature of man. But that's the lesson tonight. Actually, there's a overarching lesson. One was a study of doctrines. I wonder what that would be called. Doctrinology? I don't know. Just what's doctrine? You know, that kind of thing. Okay, I'm sorry. And then two ways, in among others, two that ways in which God has interacted with man. We'll see the need for that after the lesson today. And one is revelation and inspiration. I'm not sure what theology is, theology is for that. I think it's going to be a mix of epistemology and hermeneutics and maybe some other things. But just how do we learn, how do we know things from God, those kind of things. But we'll start on that Sunday. And then the other way in which God has broken into this natural world to tell us about himself and about ourselves is by the coming of Jesus, the incarnation. What's theology there? Christology, yeah, that, I guess. That's, I guess I've heard it called that. And of course, associated with that was a solution of that problem we began to see in our study of the nature of God. What was that one character of God that seemed like the most important with regard to his relationship to man? Holiness. And really, and you'll see why when we look at the nature of man as well. But anyway, then that actual atonement leads to the study of salvation. What is man's part? What is God's part? That would be soteriology, I think, is the name for that. And then the church is the way we act, the way we work together, the plan for God's people, the group of people. Anybody know the ology that goes with that? Ecclesiology, I think, is what goes with that. And then as in ecclesia, I think is the idea, maybe it goes. And then finally, the last one would be the end things. And what's theology that goes with that? Eschatology. Yeah, you know, there are other essential doctrines that maybe they don't make the cut. So Blaine jumped on me after class one of the times, and he said, well, now, wait a minute. We've studied God. What about this? And Michael's lesson came to mind, love God. Right, what are the two great commandments? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and what? Love your neighbor as yourself. I wonder if our kindness and relationship with others isn't maybe an essential doctrine. Is it necessary to please God? Remember our four criteria, right? And so maybe more general term would be just the morality, character, including kindness and other things. That is, what does God require of us in terms of behavior? That might be a good... That's probably an essential set. Is it necessary for us to all achieve some standard of morality to be able to work and worship together? Yeah, I think so. In fact, we're instructed to keep the church pure in that way. So there are probably others that we could look at, but that's the limit of time that we have to look at. I looked for it, but I did when I was at home and could look for it in the book I know it's in. I didn't think to do it, but it's a book Francis Schaeffer wrote, and I think it's The God Who Is There. He started to say, he kind of came out of unbelief, and he said that when he began to study Christianity, he thought that he would have all these doubts, and in my mind, I pictured there would be like balloons floating in the sky, and that he'd find someone who would just shoot all those balloons down one at a time, and that would eliminate all his doubts, and somehow that would solve his problem. He said he didn't find that at all. What he found was a complex system with all the interrelated parts that made a complete composite whole for him. And it wasn't, and so those doubts or concerns or thoughts that he had actually got incorporated into the system as answers, but part of a larger picture of how God and man relates. I hope you can see kind of some of that here. These are not doctrines in isolation of each other. They form a whole about man's relationship to God. So our foundational assumptions, I'll try to go quick. What one believes matters. And so what you teach, the doctrine that matters. The Bible's inspired. That's where we're going to go to. Now, we didn't study inspiration of Scripture and the proofs of that. We've skipped over that, but we're assuming it in this study. God's revealed all that we need to know. That is, it's complete. So those two kind of go together. Number two talks about it's exclusive. No need to look anywhere else. And number three says that everything you need is in there. And number four, some doctrines are essential. That's, we talked about the four criteria for that. It's possible to determine truth on essential doctrines because God holds us accountable to believe those. And then what one believes will be expressed in behavior. And then one kind of miscellaneous point, which is we probably won't figure out a whole bunch of things over time because we're limited as humans in our ability, our understanding, our maturity. But the things that are essential, we can. Those that are not, and some things we can just never know, but we can disagree on those things. All right. Lesson three, at the end of this class period, about 30 minutes from now, I hope to come back to this chart, and I would like you to be able to describe what's special about God's creation of man. I'd like you to be able to name the part of man that makes him unique in this physical world in which we live. List four moral characteristics of man that we get teaching from the Bible. List four false doctrines about mankind and give examples of the consequences of these in people's thinking. Okay. This is where you're supposed to remind me. But that just did remind me. So we've ended the lesson on false teaching about God and with its chart. You remember that if you were here Sunday morning. And then there's a similar one at the end of this lesson if you've got the lesson sheets. All the lessons, by the way, the entire packet is on the table in the back. And now these charts, front and back, are on the table in the back, right by the bulletin. You may have seen them coming in. That will keep you from getting writer's cramp if you want to take notes on those. So anybody watch the debates last night? Don't admit it if you did. God didn't. I think that they're still going on tonight, aren't they? Man, missing that. But that's okay. I'm going to summarize some of the points that we likely heard last night. And I didn't hear these. Actually, I heard a little bit of the news headlines, so I'm pretty sure these are the kind of things that these candidates would have said. I struggled over whether to do this or not. I am not trying to be political. I'm not trying to be a pro or con against any of these points. But I just want to say, do you think one of the candidates maybe last night said something like this? Health care is a human right? You think one of the candidates might have said that? They might have asked him where it is in the Constitution. He said, it doesn't matter. It's a human right. But anyway, I shouldn't have said he. He or she might have said that. And do you think that was said last night? Just that. Yes, okay, you're right. I don't know. What's implied about the perception of humans in that comment? Is there some implication there? Please don't argue with the factuality of that or the practical implementation politically. Tell me, what does this imply that this person believes? Yes. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and there's something unique about humans that for some reason, if they're sick, they have a right. In whose eyes? In what context? At what cost? They have a right to be cared for and made well. Isn't that what's being said there? And where do you get that idea? Do you think this was said? High health care and drug costs are the result of the greed of corporate executives. Do you think that might have been said last night? Just, I don't know if it was or not, but the probability that somebody probably said that. What does that imply about humans? Don't argue with it. Just. Yeah. Interesting. And some of those motives are bad, and some are good, right? Right. I mean, I guess if those same corporate executives did something out of some benevolent spirit, however we want to define that, we'd approve of that. But this one. We want to go after them, right? We want to take their money away. So there's some sense of justice behind that. You see that? Do you agree with that? Don't argue with it. Don't argue with me. I'm just telling you, does this imply something? And people generally just believe about humans. Some people are greedy and they do bad things and they ought not to, and we ought to stop them All those things are implied in that. How about this? Do you think this was said? We can't turn people who are fleeing violence and poverty away at the border. You think anybody said that last night? I should stop saying that. Has this ever been said before, ever? And yeah. What does that imply about people? About an assumption about people. Yeah, I mean, that's in that kind of behind that, right? And that is, if somebody's hurting or, you know, about to get killed or in some kind of a bad way, there's some inherent justice in helping them, even to our own harm. Is that kind of implied in the statement? Yeah. Okay, I'm not in favor. I'm just telling you, you see that? And then there's this person, unnamed person, continues to make racist remarks and policies. What's implied in that statement about the nature of man? Well, pardon, say it. Okay, well, but yeah, yep, Danny? And? Yeah, Aaron, what? Blaine? Yeah. Is the implication that racist remarks are wrong? Why would they be wrong? Wouldn't you think that's kind of what's implied there? I mean, what makes racism wrong? Really, if it's not that all people are kind of the same and ought to be valued the same and ought not to be punished or criticized or insulted in some way. Isn't that a premise behind this comment? Yes, Barrett? Okay, I like that. So whether we think this is true or not, if a person says a thing that's not good, they have in their conscience decided that that's okay to do that, right? They have made a decision to do something, in this case speak, in a way that's probably not defensible. Yeah. Whoever said this is making that judgment about the choice that another person made to do something that's unpleasant, undesirable. Probably we'd even say evil, right? Okay, are y'all okay with these things? I'm not being too political, am I? I see some confused looks. I'm not defending her. We'll do one more. We must stamp out injustice in our legal system. What's that imply? Think they said that? Too many people are incarcerated and all that kind of thing. What does that imply? Yeah, Grant? Yeah, yeah. Not only is there something going wrong, there's an ought, if sometimes called an ought, that we ought to step up to and try to fix it, at least as a society, if not as individuals. Have I made the point, okay, that there is a kind of a lot of assumptions about human nature and about the nature of man that kind of are rooted in, I think, a pretty spiritual view of man. Otherwise, I don't see where you get some of these values that are implied in these statements. But no one questions the statements, really. They may question politically, you know, what ought to be done about it, but, right, you see what I'm saying? I mean, these are based on, nobody argues, because the Bible says that humans are created in the image of God, health care and kindness to immigrants or whatever. No, they don't argue that. It's just an assumed thing. And I think we all live that way. I think we live fairly consistent with that core beliefs. Sinful people, as we are, we know if this is right, whether we live up to it or not. Okay, are we okay with that, or can we put that behind us? I didn't mean to be too sensitive, but I was thinking about that this afternoon. Okay, here's some things about man that we should know, and that is, he is created. He is a product of God's speaking words into the physical world, and man comes into being as he is, as we are, each of us. And that means we're like rocks and sticks, right? And air and sky and rain, aren't we? I mean, we're like dust, actually, is I think one image the Bible uses. That's, in fact, if you look at all of our chemicals, they're kind of all on the periodic table as far as what we're actually composed of. But there's something special about that, and as we're in God's image. Again, these letters match the lesson material if you want to fill these in as we go. So in Genesis 2, 7, God formed, this is a kind of recounting, it seems like, of day 6 in chapter 1. The Lord, or Jehovah God, formed man out of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living spirit. In the account of the flood killing everybody, chapter 7, verse 22, the word breath spirit is used there. That's the same spirit word, ruach, I think it is. It's describes God's spirit as well. But anyway, there's something special. We were made, and then there was some animation that occurred. And I think we share that with the animals. The same word is used. In fact, that's used of the animals in chapter 7, verse 22. But something else. Something else. And it's actually said three times as if to be very emphasized. Genesis 1:27, God created man in his own image. That's what, after having mentioned the verse before, but this is what we're about to do. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So in the image of God, whatever that means, it's not, that is not said about the animals. The interesting thing, too, is that the word create is not used very much in that first chapter. I think we've talked about this before. God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which seems to suggest called into being from nothing. But then he said, let there be. And so all the days until the animals appeared, there was just an organizing of that. And until the actual life and breath began with the animals and then with man. So it's a special word. And here it's used three times about God's action. James picks up on this, and I think we can relate these to some of those political statements. You know, that's why it's wrong to curse people with racist comments or whatever, you know, whatever insulting things there are. Why is that, James says? Why is it wrong? Well, we bless with our mouth, we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men. He says, that's inconsistent. Why is that inconsistent? To curse a man. Because kind of by reference, you're cursing God. We're created in the similitude, New King James, or likeness of God. That's an interesting value system implied there. And then Psalm 8. And I think this is one of the... I'm going to come back and ask this question. How much of man's nature could you actually know without the Bible's revelation? And I gave you examples in the previous chart about a lot of things that we all kind of assume are true. Do we just assume them, or have we figured some of them out by observing man and observing ourselves? What is man that you're mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you visit him? You've made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. Could you know that without having read that psalm, Psalm 8, or some of that? That we're really... we're kind of something more special about us than the rest of the world, right? Kind of like if you believed in angels, I don't know, some spiritual or supernatural element within man. Seems like what he's implying. And then crowned him with glory and honor. So we're created. We're in God's image. We're different, though, from the rest of the world and have a spiritual nature. Now, here's some of the things that the Bible says about the spirit of the man. So Zechariah 12. This is just... this is just a little bit like a doxology, as Zechariah makes a point about God's right to judge. But he said, look, this is Jehovah. This is the Jehovah who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundation of the earth and formed the spirit of the man within him. One way to think about that is that forming the spirit may be just as amazing to think about as throwing the heavens in place or building the foundation of the earth. And he put the spirit of man within him. Or maybe it has to do with his right to judge us. Ecclesiastes 12 describes death. And at death, the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. We'll look back at Ecclesiastes 12 in just a minute. And then Jesus said, don't fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. So it's suggesting there's two elements. Comments on that? I really want you to have in the back of your mind that question. How much of this could we figure out? Kind of like, you know, the eternal power and deity of God. Remember that from Romans 1? The idea is we should be able to figure that out. And by the way, I had the reference wrong. It's Acts 14. Paul was in Lystra and said, God, you could see God's goodness in that he sends the rain and the seasons. Those are things we could figure out about God if we were interested in seeing those things. This is interesting. All men of one blood. And so Adam called his wife's name Eve. Why? Because she was the mother of all living. I assume that means living people, the idea of all men. And then Paul, in dealing with those philosophers in Athens, said that, verse 26, well, first he gives life and breath to all and all things, but he made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth. Now, that's the New King James. And the word blood is there in the New King James. And it's in the Greek. But it's not in many of the translations. They just say he made of one. I think maybe ESV just puts made of one man or something, every nation. But the sense of blood is, well, you tell me. What does it mean of one blood? What's the idea of that? Does it mean we can all exchange blood and transfusion should work from anybody to anybody? I hope not, because it doesn't. What's that? Okay, that's good. So I skipped over. I was going to make a reference to that. Do you know that that special image of God creation is again referred to in Genesis chapter 9 when Noah comes out of the ark and he said, that's the reason that if someone kills someone else, they need to be executed and punished with death. Why is that? Because they've killed something that's in the image of God. That's not in the lesson, but that's a point that I think that goes with that. Interesting, it's almost the upside down. You'd think, well, you shouldn't take anybody's life, but no, there actually is a case where a person deserves to die, and the reason is because they've destroyed something that's in God's image. That's what God tells Noah there in Genesis chapter 9, I think verse 6. But back to this one. So I looked up the word blood in the Greek, and you'll never guess what it means. Yeah, that's right. It means blood, yeah. It actually is used sometimes when you squeeze a grape and the stuff that comes out is sometimes called... But really, we would know what... If somebody says the blood of the grape, you'd know what that meant. That's just an image. I'm squeezing something out of the grape. So what does that mean? I think at some point in time, there may have been, probably as a result of Darwinism and others, this idea that different races of men were inferior to others. I think that's a natural consequence of Darwin. But this verse was kind of used by Christians to say, no, actually everybody has the same blood or something. Like it's all hemoglobin after all, right? No matter what color your skin or that kind of thing. I don't know for sure that that's the idea here. That may be true too, but I don't... I think it's just the essence, the life essence of someone is the same for all people. And it's just like when you squeeze a grape, stuff comes out. And that's the same with people. We have a common nature. I think that's the idea. Okay, and all the face of the earth. So not some part of the globe where there's a different race or some other thing. And I think, too, this determined their pre-appointed times. That seems to imply God not only manages where the boundaries of their dwellings, places on the earth that they are, but also the periods of time that they're in power or that they exist. He's actually managing history. So that's that four-dimensional box we were talking about, right? Before, like the space where you live, but also how long you live and who's in power and that kind of thing. So that's all. That's back on the nature of God, but you can see despite those differences in location and in history and all of that, still it's all one blood, one essence that describes people. Does everyone believe that in the world? I don't think so, and we'll see maybe some of the reasons. So there's my question. What do you think you could know about God without revelation? And you have to tell me how you know that or how you think you might know that. What comes to your mind? A conscience. Why do you think you could know that about men? Okay. You're using third person. Somebody does something they feel bad about. She says she feels bad about it. Now, she's the only one in here, I'm sure, that has that experience. Is that our... Yeah, Michael? And that's kind of empirically observable, right? In societies, but also... And I didn't mean to embarrass you about that. Not that I'm telling you should feel guilty, but... Is this a personal experience that we've all had? Oh man, I think so. Right? And there's some kind of argument which doesn't seem to me make a lot of sense, and say, well, that's because your parents put it in you. Right? Well, okay. Where did your parents get that from? I mean, there's still this question, how did this get into human race? And so there's a lot of the more worldly anthropology. Yeah, Alonda. Right.
There's times with, you know, our children where, you know, we might not have addressed a certain behavior, but
they figured out that if they did it, they probably should kind of either check mom to see what's going to happen to me, or maybe go and hide or something like that. Yeah, I think that's true. Well, I think that's one thing. So a conscience. What else? So we've defined maybe that there's something inherent in us that knows that, and I think. I'll make a reference again to Dave Hamlet's lesson. I don't remember his invitation. I think it was. Where he was just saying, we can see in ourselves something special, so when we harm someone else, that those kind of things just seem like they're wrong. Yeah,
Philip. You think about people that have been injured and lost a limb, but they didn't stop being themselves. So you realize that we're more than just our bodies.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. Right. And I think the whole idea that healthcare is a human right, that kind of a value system says if you're human, if you put that in there, there's something special. And the humanists, it seemed to me, are kind of stuck to explain why it is that humanity deserves to be preserved, that that's their goal. I don't really see the value system, but everybody believes it. It's not hard to sell people on that idea, no matter what your religious background is. So I'm kind of trying to get to one other idea, too. Okay, let's say more about that. Doesn't seem that they do. And we would, yeah, that's true. So there is maybe a sense of strategy or abstract thought and things that we just don't see the evidence of. I mean, over time, I know monkeys can be taught to kind of do some basic vocabulary with certain signs, whether they can form it with the words themselves, but it just seems like that's just very little beyond plain old Pavlovian type conditioning, you know, in response, but I don't know. Yeah, Grant? Thank you. Yeah. Are you sure? So, I think I could make this hard philosophically. Are you sure you're really choosing something, right? So it kind of fits with the idea of feeling guilty about stuff, doesn't it? Why do you feel guilty if you didn't have a choice to make about it? You know what I mean? You regret having done something, and that implies that you could not done it. I don't know how to say that, right? You could have somehow avoided doing it. You know what I mean? But you just kind of believe that. And go back to those quotes from the debate. Do almost every one of those suggest that people are making either bad choices or good choices, or maybe when they get to the ballot box, they ought to make a right choice or something, you know? I think we see that. And I'll tell you what, even if you kind of have decided that we're in a deterministic system and we're all just a product of electrons and chemicals and stimulus and genetics and all that, and that's all we are, just a machine in the bigger machine, we sure don't live that way. And we don't hold others accountable, or let's say, guiltless. We presume that they've made a choice when they hurt us, or they do something that's dishonest, or, you know, hurt other people, that kind of thing. Yeah, those are very good. I think you could know that about yourself, and I think those are empirical observations. If you just opened up your own brain and conscience and thought about it, you would see, yes, how did that get into me? And maybe that's another evidence clearly seen, like the eternal power and deity of God, of the nature of God and the nature of man. So Paul makes some similar points in Romans 1 about the Gentiles who did not have the law, which we would presume that means the creation story and the understanding of God creating man in his image. They know the righteous judgment of God somehow, that those who practice things are deserving of death. That almost suggests that we inherently know that some bad deeds deserve punishment. You ever feel that way? It's funny that you... Well, I won't go into that, but you do hear people who might have been very, very peace-loving, and then some mass murderer kills one of their children, and they suddenly become kind of feeling like maybe there ought to be some justice here. And they talk about closure. And I don't know what they mean by that, if they don't mean some kind of a consequence for that evil deed. And they'd only do the same, but approve of those that practice. That makes them even whatever that word would be, somebody who helps someone do something. Yeah, accomplices. Thank you. Yeah. For when the Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things in the law, these, although they not having a law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thought accusing or else excusing. I think that's what this means. He's saying that the Gentiles really ought, they're kind of without excuse, not only because of the creation, but because of what they ought to see in themselves. They kind of know some things are wrong. One way to think about it is, I know if something hurts me, I figured that out, and so I ought to know that it hurts someone else if I did the same thing to them. And I think we figure that out. And so as a result, we hold people accountable for their choices. So keep going. I think we just covered this one. Then there's an interesting other point about that is, and that is, even though I know it's wrong, can I ignore that in my mind? Can I just stop thinking about the fact that it's wrong after a while? I think the Bible suggests that's possible too. He says, to the pure all things are pure, those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, but their mind and conscience are defiled. I don't know what that means if it doesn't include, at least, that they don't think right anymore. It's all twisted. It's dirty. And so everything looks dirty, the way they think about it. And anyway, another similar passage in 1 Timothy 4, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own consciences seared as with a hot iron. There's some kind of behavior that if it's extended long enough, you finally just stop feeling that guilt that was kind of a proof that God had put a special nature in you. You can finally just do away with that sensation. Seems like what he's saying there. And then, ability to make choices. And Paul talks about that dilemma, that struggle within himself in Romans 7. To will is present within me. If you read that text, he talks about these influences, even kind of calls them laws, as if they were forces of influence on him. And one is the flesh, which is pulling him to do the things that his body, his carnal desires lead him to do. The other is his mind that's aware of the law of God, and he wants to follow it. In his own mind, he says, I really do want to do that. But he is somehow caught in the middle, and I don't know that this is the third-party thing, but there's a will that somehow arbitrates between those two. So it's almost like a third-party influence, or at least an impartial arbiter that chooses between those two influences. That's the way I read the passage. To will is present, but how to perform what is good I do not find. Do you sense that in the passage, that there's an independent choice between these two influences? And of course, chapter 7 and 8 are about how to get the Spirit, the mind of the Spirit, and this inclination to follow the will of God, how to get that to be stronger and overwhelm the desires of the flesh. And so the choices always are in that direction. 2 Peter 3, I like this passage a lot. They willfully forget. Are we good forgetters? Now, they didn't actually get amnesia. They just chose to ignore this point that Peter's talking about, which is that God will judge the world eventually. But they've forgotten the evidence of that, looking at the history of the world. We're so good at that. Again, a choice we make, even against logic in some cases. And then Romans 6, do you not know that whom you present yourselves as slaves, you're that one's slaves, whether of sin leading to death or obedience leading to righteousness. Does that imply a choice? It seems to me the whole context is to say, don't make the wrong choice, because you'll be a slave to the wrong thing and not the right thing. So that's B4B. And then, kind of following that logic, all right, we have a sense of conscience, right and wrong. We do make choices, right? We're influenced two different ways, and we have this choice mechanism that exists above those things. And we always make the right choice, right? Well, no, unfortunately not. And so that conscience then kind of bears witness with that choice we've made and the fact that we do have a choice that we've just messed up. Which would not be that big of a deal unless we were going to be judged one day, right? Unless somebody bigger than us was going to hold us accountable. We've kind of studied that already. But there's no difference. We've all sinned and fall short. That's the Jews and Gentiles alike. We know whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped, that all the world may become guilty before God. Are we better than they? Not at all. We've previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they're all under sin, all from Romans 3. And then the quote from Isaiah 53, and then quoted again in the New Testament, I think Peter at least and others. We've all turned everyone to his own way. Notice in that, he doesn't say some of us have been going the wrong way from the very beginning. Do you see in that a choice that's been made? We've turned. We've actually made a choice to our own way as opposed to God's way. These are not new points, I hope. So we've seen three things about man. These are, remember our objectives, four things to remember, right? Conscience, we have a choice, we're sinful. And then another one is that we're all going to die. That should be empirically obvious, right? But I think it's also empirically obvious that we all kind of think something is beyond death. Do you ever sense that? Even in the absence of logic or anybody who's ever come back from the dead, we kind of don't really like the idea that death is the end of it all. I think that's uniquely human. Doesn't prove anything, except that we have been, I think, put within us some aspirations beyond this life. And maybe you've beaten that out of yourself, I don't know, as an unbeliever, but I think all of us kind of have that in a sense that there's something beyond. But anyway, the Bible tells us that we are going to die, and that after that there will be a judgment. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each can receive the deeds done in the body, whether good or bad. Somehow, Solomon, I guess, writing Ecclesiastes, kind of said, God's really going to judge this when it's all over with. Every secret thing, whether good or evil. So he mentions that even in the Old Testament. So those are four things. Can we remember those four? Conscience, choice, sin, judgment. Those are, I think, we're accountable. We're accountable for those choices and that sin that we've committed. So, let's talk about that. I'll remind you that one of our fundamental principles is what you believe does govern how you live. Isn't that true? And I one passage that keeps coming to my mind is this one. If the dead don't rise, and you can almost say to judgment, right? If that's not going to ever, if I'm ever called to account for how I've lived in this life, then should I live in a different way? Should my life be informed by that kind of, this is all there is, get to this, the end of this life, and whoever has the most toys wins, or whatever the value system you've adopted, that's a different way to live. Anyway, so what are some of the, can you think of some false doctrines? Oops, I'm going to show this. What are some false doctrines? You can almost negate some of what we said before. Well, I'll just show these for sake of time. Do you think there are those who would assert that man is merely an animal? Just kind of evolved from the same primordial goo or whatever that the animals started from. We just have kind of made it farther somehow in terms of our intellect or something. Yes, Steve? I couldn't help it. Yeah, right. It's just my instincts. I was following my instincts. Instincts are what guide animals. Yeah, I heard the story about the little turtles. I guess they're coming back, the loggerheads, right? Being born on the coast. Way more than ever before this year. They seem to be recovering. They pop out of the sand and they just make a beeline for the ocean. How do they know which way that is? How do they know to crawl? And they go right into the water and swim 30 miles without stopping. They're this big. Anyway, I don't know. That's instinct, right? They can't help it. That's your point, right? So there are things I do. It'd be easy to say, well, I just came out of the shell and that's what happened. Okay. If you believe that, or if you felt like that in similar, the man makes no choices, that really I have chemical, electrical components and the environment stimulates me and what I do is just what I do. I'm just a machine within the larger machine. What consequences would that have for the way you might live or view others or think? Can you think of some things? Yeah, you can't really hold somebody accountable in some sense of doing evil, right? And Aaron kind of says there's not much point in rules, really, because I'm just going to do, but maybe there's some way to condition me or whack me or put me a fence around me or something, but I can't be held guilty for not doing that. Yes. Yeah, no place to give thanks or, yeah, right. In a way, you're destroying joy and sadness, I guess, in a sense, because what is. What happens is what is. What's right is just what happens. So here are some of the ideas there. No right and wrong. There's no accountability or guilt for actions, no matter how harmful they are. Each man should just follow his own instincts, and that's kind of a growing thing, right? I mean, I was born this way. I have a desire of a certain kind, so that's what I should live. And the proof that that's right is because I was born that way, or it's a natural desire. After all, we're not anything more than natural desires. And we shouldn't blame men for their bad behavior, even if it harms us or others. And then, I think, too, it says that really, if what is, or might makes right or whatever, the fittest should probably survive, and maybe others should not. And I don't know if I can get there quickly enough, but I want you to read this quote. I'm going to make sure we do this. Read this quote. And I mentioned before that that kind of our worldview has led, I think, to some of the racist ideas and some of the ideas of the way they're superior people over other people. Read this. With savages, the weak in body or mind, savages means uncivilized tribes, I guess maybe on some island or something, away from civilization. The weak in body and mind are soon eliminated. Why is that? Well, they're not fit, right? They're not productive. They can't make their way. They can't fight their way to defend themselves, whatever. And we civilized men, and you can tell this is written by somebody from England by that spelling, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the process of elimination. Stop the process of eliminating the weaker. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, the sick. We institute poor laws. Our medical men exert their utmost skills to save the life of everyone to the last moment. There's reason to believe that vaccination has preserved thousands who, from a weak constitution, would formerly have succumbed to smallpox. Thus, the weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. What could be worse than that? We got knuckleheads and weak-bodied people who are having babies all over the place. Isn't that what he's saying? No one who's attended the breeding of domestic animals would doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. Anybody disagree with that? It's surprising how soon a want of care, or care wrongly directed, leads to the degeneration of a domestic race. But excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed with each other. You get what he's saying? What's he saying? Or she, I'm not telling you who it is. What's the idea here? If your view is we're just natural, like the domesticated animals, right? Are there some among us who are inferior in some way, weaker in mind and body? What should we do with them? Pardon? Yeah, so at least sterilize them. I mean, at least start with that, right? But maybe even go beyond that and get them out of the way. Because they're non-productive, right? In fact, they're not just non-productive, they're a burden. Right? We're out trying to save them till the last minute. Does this bother you at all? Does this seem like a... And is it a natural consequence of believing we're just animals and we just are what we are and we're in a process of evolution and we're caught within it and we ought to maybe just accelerate that instead of trying to fight it, like preserving weak people and that kind of thing? Yeah, Philip? Yeah. Which might not be the best for their survival or the physical benefit of the human race or other things. But at the heart of it, they're in the image of God, no matter what's wrong with them, right? And they have value for that reason, not because they're productive in society or because they have good genes, right, for future preservation of the human race. Anybody have any idea who wrote this? That's a real good guess, yeah. Ha ha. Well, no, they spell civilization with an S, so they're not from... Yeah. Shouldn't have kids, for sure, right? Yeah. All right, we didn't get back to the others, but I'll just show you the others here. One is that man makes no choice. We said that man's inherently good. You see a problem with that? We never do anything wrong. We're always good, onward and upward, always progressing. And the other is we're inherently evil. We never do anything wrong. We can't even make good choices. Neither of those is really right. We're somewhere in the middle where we're accountable. We choose between good and evil. And the news is God's going to judge us for how we've chosen those things. So that creates a problem, doesn't it? The holiness of God and the nature of man who makes choices and is accountable to him. How's that? Did we get there? I'm going to show this chart and we can pretend we actually got to the end. But here they are. Special about man, part that makes him unique, four moral characteristics and four false teachings. Did we get there close enough? All right, Sam, take over Sunday morning.